Welcome back to Gold Ribbon Conversations, the podcast created to support families fighting childhood cancer in Ireland. 6 children, adolescents and young adults are diagnosed with cancer every week in Ireland. And the Gold Ribbon, which illuminates precious light, love, courage and compassion, is a symbol of strength and solidarity for each and every one. My name is Sinead O'Moore, and it is my privilege to bring you this podcast on behalf of Childhood Cancer Ireland, a charity founded by and led by parents of children with cancer and survivors who know that one of the greatest sources of strength for this fight is conversation. Throughout this podcast, I talk to families impacted by childhood cancer, as well as the experts who care for our children's health, education and happiness. Yes, we talk about the fear and the pain, but we also talk about the hope and the friendship and the community that exists here, because you are not alone. Childhood Cancer Ireland values every single donation while on its mission to help more children, adolescents and young adults survive cancer and thrive as adults, and support all those dealing with the long-term effects of illness and trauma. Welcome back to a new season of Gold Ribbon Conversations. Over the next 5 weeks, you'll hear inspiring and supportive stories from guests connected to fighting childhood cancer. Today, I'm joined by Walter Kolch, Director of Systems Biology Ireland and Conway Institute UCD, and one of the founding members of Childhood Cancer Ireland, Alan Pearson, who are working together in what is the biggest investment in cancer research in Ireland. Precision Oncology Ireland is a consortium of 5 Irish universities, 6 Irish cancer charities, and 7 international companies. It is cutting edge, and there is no other consortium like this in the world. It started out as purely research focused, but they recognised how important it was to include patients. The goal is to help people to live normal lives, to understand these diseases much better so that they can design better treatments by understanding why the therapies work and why they fail. As a parent who has walked this path, Alan expresses what it means for patients and parents, how the patient voice is heard, and what it can mean for the future. Walter and Alan, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Gold Ribbon Conversations. This is it's a bit of a different one, because while I have had conversations with those that are in our medical teams, and I have had conversations that have come from the parent experience, this is a special one where I have a voice from both, but that are working together in the pursuit of developing something incredibly special and hopeful for those that are part of the cancer fight right now. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
I want to start by helping the audience understand something that I'm only learning about now, which is that there is a group of experts, a group of heads, and Walter, I think you expressed this so wonderfully as we were chatting before I hit record. And it's this idea that more heads are better than one. And when it comes to looking at how we can support those that are fighting cancer in the future, that there has been this decision that actually, how can people with the knowledge and with the research come together, put their heads together, share that information and create solutions together? Tell me more about this initiative.
Yeah, so I think you're referring to Precision Oncology Ireland, which is the consortium that I'm leading. And that's a consortium between 5 Irish universities, 6 Irish cancer charities and 7 industry partners. And as you said, it's basically a consortium where we try to stick our heads together to come up with better cures for cancer, better diagnostics of cancer. And it's really motivated by that, what we've seen as researchers, that we have now wonderful technologies like genome sequencing, but it also can characterize proteins, metabolites. So we have made huge progress in research, but it only trickles very slowly through to the clinic and to the patient. So what motivates us is trying to accelerate this process, get this really great fundamental research to the bedside much quicker so that we can make an impact much quicker. And this is why we up in the form of this consortium to accelerate the process.
Is this kind of work being done anywhere else in the world, or is Ireland particularly fortunate to have this consortium here?
So cancer research, of course, is done worldwide, and also our own efforts are globally well anchored. So we collaborate with people in the States, we collaborate with people in Europe, in Germany, in France, in the UK. So research is very international, but what is unique to that consortium is really this constellation of bringing universities, charities, and industry together in one consortium. And it's working really well because everybody brings a different perspective. So researchers often bring the fundamental perspective, but the industry knows actually how to get these fundamental things into practice. And the charities are very important because they give us the patient perspective, they give us the perspective of the public. So it works together really well.
Alan, tell me about the perspective that you bring to this.
Yeah, so I'm the parent. I'm one of the parents that's gone through the journey of childhood cancer, unfortunately with the wrong result. My daughter, Cleena, was diagnosed 2 weeks after her fourth birthday with neuroblastoma, a cancer that is very, very difficult to treat. It's probably got one of the most complex treatment regimes in all of childhood oncology, if not in oncology. She battled for 6 years. We had periods of relapse, we had periods of relief, but unfortunately she passed away a couple of weeks before her 10th birthday as a result of her disease. Throughout that, one of the hardest things we found was not necessarily just dealing with the treatment, but dealing with what the treatment brings with it, the side effects, the lifelong potential side effects. And one of the things that I hope for precision oncology on behalf of patients and their families in childhood cancer is that with true precision oncology, that we come up with kinder, better, more targeted treatments. And I think what inspires me about what Walter and Precision Oncology are doing as a group is they're looking for that precision. They're looking for that, you know, instead of carpet bombing the system, they're looking for the single silver bullet that can help a child with a difficult cancer. And then, you know, through that, increase the number of survivors, but importantly, increase the quality of survivorship as well for children. Because if a child is diagnosed with a cancer early and gets this widespread, far-ranging amount of side effects as a result of the treatment, the rest of their life, they're paying for paying the price at. If in the future we can come to a point where we can precision target that cancer and eliminate or grossly reduce the side effects, then not only will we create more survivors, but those survivors will have a better future ahead of them. And the families associated with them will have a better future ahead of them. So that's where I come from, and that's why I'm interested in what Walter and his team do in the world of precision oncology.
That's a really important point, Alan, because we need to personalize treatment, right? At the moment, we treat the average because, you know, our medicine is based on big clinical studies, and then we sort of treat the average patient out of the study. And that actually works really well. You know, if you break a leg or for infections, the same treatment works for everybody. But if it comes to complex diseases like cancer, we need to have personalized treatments where we really treat individual patients. And yeah, as you say, this is actually this precision element which we are trying to get in there so that we really can target the therapy, not give too much to reduce the side effects, but just gives the right amount and it still is effective. So that's a very important point.
Yeah. And we've talked about it before with other guests that have been on the podcast. You know, Nikki Bradley is coming to mind, and just the impact of this life-saving treatment, but the toxicity levels creating lifelong challenges. Also, I'm thinking of Carl, who was talking about even just his fatigue and how he feels like he's supposed to be at a time in his life where, you know, he's in that young adult category, and it's like he's ready to begin. He's ready to start his life and to live as a young adult, but he doesn't have the energy to pursue a career or, you know, to fully engage in, you know, the fun aspects of being 20. Yeah. And he in that episode, I remember him talking about this, about saying, my cancer is over. I've beaten it. But now I need to figure out how to rebuild a life for me to live.
Yeah. And I think I've met Carl, and he's a great guy. And he is, as you say, in that adult and young adolescent, or adolescent and young adult cancer space. And can speak quite eloquently about what that means to him. For me, the people that I think pay a high price as well are young kids, because they don't even get to experience life. For example, if you have children, you know, that are very young, 2, 3, 4, or even younger than that, they're automatically starting off if they survive, with a future of limitation, which is not right and not fair. We're increasingly kind of understanding that for years medicine has treated children as small adults. But they're not small adults, they're completely different. Walter can talk to how different they are physically and metabolically and all of those kind of aspects, and the amount of development they have to do post-treatment, which is hampered by the types of agents we give them and the type of medicines. But emotionally and mentally, they're different as well. They just want to play. They just want to have fun. They just want to go to school. And often it's not the treatment that stops them going to school. It's the side effects of the treatment. So, for example, with my daughter, she missed a significant amount of school because she was neutropenic. And parents like me will understand that word. But, you know, it means that they're very vulnerable, or else that they had no platelets, so they couldn't go because there was a fear of bleeding or, you know, damage. And so it's not actually the period of treatment, it's the period post-treatment that really limits them. And then if you have a child whose life is going to be short as a result of their cancer, your only desire as a parent is to make them enjoy that time. And a lot of this, the complex treatments we give them, steal that from them and steal it from us.
Yeah, and also the treatment takes very long, right? It's even the successful treatments in childhood cancer, they go on over 3-4 years as a sustained. Yeah. So it's a huge amount of time in the life of a child and in the lives, yeah, of families. So, and this is really something what we need to improve. Fortunately, the cure rates in childhood cancers are much higher than in adult cancers, but the price for surviving is also higher because of these, you know, very long-term side effects which children can experience. And this is actually, we have projects on childhood cancer in Precision Oncology Ireland, and this is actually one of the main thrusts where we try to develop treatments in a personalized, more precise way, which can reduce the toxicity. It will take a few years till they actually clinically being used, because we have to make sure that they still work. So at the moment we're doing this sort of an observational basis. We develop our therapeutic suggestions on computers, and we run them alongside a patient's journey and to see how well our computer predictions would actually correspond to the outcomes. And we call this digital twin modeling, because we basically make a digital twin of the patient in the computer, and we treat the patient in the computer. But hopefully in a 3-4 years time, when we have proved that these models actually behave like a real patient, you know, then we can simulate the treatment on the computer, we can change the treatment on the computer, and we can adjust it exactly to the person, and then we can give as much as needed, but not too much, because serious.
I think that's, Walter, I remember one of the very first times I visited you guys out in Precision Oncology and Systems Biology Ireland, and one of your researchers presented that graph. And the graph was basically how much medicine is given to the child and when does the response stop? Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to me because a lot of the protocols for children say, give 6 rounds of this, give 8 rounds of this, do this. And you're always wondering as a parent going, am I giving them too much or am I giving them too little? Do I need to put my child through this? And in numbers, what I saw in Walter's lab was the ability to measure that progress of the response, right, versus the amount given. And sometimes what you could see is we continued to give after the response was no longer happening. Now, that response might not be happening because, you know, fantastic, the child has a much lower burden of disease, or that the cancer has changed, especially on relapse. And Walter's probably best positioned to talk about that. But sometimes the cancer the child gets is not the cancer that they're treated for by the end of their regime, or that they unfortunately die from, because it's changed. And being able to pick up that point in time where the cancer has changed or gone or improved, and then switch either to something that is effective against the changed cancer or is less detrimental to the child. That's what really fascinated me about seeing what Walter and the team do, was that single curve I saw on a screen in the lab.
What has it meant to you, Alan, that having come through this journey, having had lost your daughter, what does it mean to you to be able to sit in the world of this science and to see what is potentially happening next, to stay so close and to stay so engaged to it? Has that supported you in your next steps through this journey? Because it's a forever journey. If you've gone through it, it's long lasting. But yeah. It will be difficult to stay so closely engaged with what, you know, doctors or scientists or research is saying. How has it been for you, though, to sit there to see this science unfold?
Oh, that's a great question, Sinead. It's a great question, and there's so many parts to that. So what is it like to watch it unfold? There's a certain element of regret, because I often think that, and I've said this to doctors, and I think I might have said it to Walter in the past, is I might look back in the future and there'll be a point in time where I'll realize that medicine has advanced so far that Cliona didn't have to suffer the way she did, and we probably didn't have to lose her. And that's the regret side of it. But there's another element where I'm very fortunate through my own training and my own career, and you know, to be able to internalize some of the information people are given, the patient community, and maybe relay that in a different way to people who don't have my background. And for me, it's a little bit of a burden, but it's also a little bit of a reward, because I feel like everything that, you know, we went through, we can help other people go through, maybe with a little bit more understanding and less fear. Because I think a lot of emotions when you have as a parent are fear. Like, you have to inevitably trust the doctor. That's what you have to do. But you don't have the knowledge and the skills or the understanding of what's going on. So to demystify that and explain it, I think that's very rewarding for me. So yeah, difficult question, but maybe that's the yin and the yang of it, positive and negative.
But something has kept you in this space, you know, something has kept you so close to this work and to be that parent advocate. And how brilliant it is, because look, for the majority of parents that are going through this fight, as you said, they don't have the background and the knowledge in this kind of pharma space. And it's all just big words they don't understand. And that can feel intimidating, and that can feel like you have to hand over more control. Because not only do you have to hand over trust, you also don't fully understand what it is that is even being said back to you. So to have somebody like you, I think it's just such so valuable for those parents that can't be that voice in the room, but also, as Walter said, to take the science and to apply it to people's lives and, you know, make it about the mission and not just the data.
Yeah, but we actually hear this a lot from we work a lot with patient organizations, and one thing that patients really want and need is understanding, you know, how the treatment works, how the disease works, and what's happening to them. So that is a really important element. And I think for a long time, you know, we have this completely underestimated that patients actually, you know, they want to participate. And participation means you have to understand what you're doing. I think this is actually happening throughout that there's much more efforts to actually bring the patient along on the journey and have a, you know, there's not the doctor and the patient being the client, but it's a teamwork. You know, it's the doctor and the patient working as a team. So this is actually fortunately now happening in modern medicine, but it's just, I guess, our basic human desire to understand the world and to understand what's happening to us.
September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, a time when we shine a light on what it means to live with and to fight childhood cancer. This September, we mark the 10th anniversary of our Light It Up Gold campaign, when a group of parents first came together to create awareness of childhood, adolescent, and young adult cancer, and of the gold ribbon that signifies our mission. This year, we are delighted to bring back our Light It Up Gold walk on Saturday, September 23rd, a walk of hope and remembrance, a time for our community to come together in solidarity. Visit childhoodcancer.ie for more details. To help us to continue our services, please text GOLD to 50300 and donate €4, or visit childhoodcancer.ie for more.
What have you seen, Walter, when the patient and the medical team are working closer together? What results have you seen from that type of relationship?
So actually, a lot of good results. And first of all, I think the, you know, treatments which can be very rough and painful and very difficult, it is important that everybody knows why this is necessary, you know, and also sometimes it's necessary to actually deviate from the treatment path because, you know, the side effects are too big or for any other reasons. And that needs to be discussed in as a team. You know, this needs the decisions where the journey goes and, you know, what of the many side roads or main roads one can take needs to be taken jointly. So I think that's big progress. But also when the, these are very long journeys, right? So this is over years. So it's really, you want and need a relationship between going the path. And actually for me personally, I'm clinically trained. I haven't seen patients for a long time, but this was one of the things which I, when I was working in the clinic or the really, before I went into research, what I really liked was the contact with the people. You know, that was actually what made medicine very, very enjoyable. And now as a researcher, we're slowly coming back to the patients. And that's actually, you know, a sort of a great way where the circle closes. So I'm very excited. Every time I work on with patients or, you know, meet with patients, for me, that's a big motivation boost every time.
The reminder that it's about people.
Yeah.
And there is a greater will, I imagine, when they can imagine you and what you're doing and the hope that it's not just them fighting this alone, that there is actually these strangers in the world that are dedicating their entire careers. Yeah, just helping them.
It gives you context and also gives you, you know, the The life as a researcher can be very lonely, because for the simple reason, when we do research, we very often only see the results weeks later, sometimes only years later. So you don't have the satisfaction like, you know, a builder. You build something nice and you see it in the evening. We don't have this, but that satisfaction of actually then all of a sudden sort of knowing why we're doing this, you know, that is an enormous boost to keep you going. And it's like, you know, working with people like Alan, it's for me, it's a big morale boost.
I think Walter mentioned something there about people want to know what's happening and what researchers are doing. As a parent, you have the awful responsibility to sign things for your child, you know, to sign them onto a clinical trial and to sign off for samples to be taken and looked at by people in research. And, you know, we do that. We do that as part of the process of helping understand what's wrong with our child. But I think when you hear of people like Walter, who rely on that information, those samples in some cases, though, you know, that information on your patient or your child, when you hear that these people are the people working on the samples taken from your child, working on the tissue banks generated from your child and the information records from your child, you think, okay, maybe my child is contributing to someone being better off in the future. And it's when you hear people like Walter and like the team of researchers that I've been fortunate to meet throughout, you know, Precision Oncology Ireland and those organizations, you actually trust that something good will come of it, something useful will come of it. And it's not all a signature on a page that means nothing. Something will happen, something will change. And with the advent of the type of science the guys are doing now, you're hoping that you're accelerating towards that change. And that, for me, as a parent, I think there's a little bit of legacy of CLINAs being developed or helping to develop the future for other patients and other children.
And that is...
I actually have to point out how important that is, because, you know, we need these samples from the patients and to do the research. And in a way, it's really... you know, a lot of generosity and altruism there, because in only in very few cases, the patient who gives the sample actually benefits from the research we're doing, but future patients will. So it is a huge generosity and altruism, and it, we couldn't make no progress without that.
And no doubt it's a hugely challenging decision to take part in these trials, in any research. As you said, it can feel like it's just, you know, you have that pressure of signing, but there's fear there too. There's a lot of fear. You know, we can hear possibly, okay, from the outside looking in, sometimes you hear sweeping advancements in research and you want, you know, and the potential for research, but then you can hear negative personal stories.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, we believe in the investment into research and the investment into what that research can do in terms of bringing cures and bringing life-saving treatments or reducing those limiting reducing that toxicity so that people can recover and recover well. But there are then the stories, I suppose, of where research, what that means, you know, really what that means for the individual to take part.
Yeah, you've touched on some really important points there, Sinead, particularly in and around childhood cancer as it relates to clinical trials and the fear and the concern that parents have. The reality of childhood cancer is that, particularly in Ireland, up to 80% of children are treated as part of clinical trials. That's just the way medicine is delivered for children in Ireland. That's because if you look at small patient groups, questions of research aren't answered on small patient groups. You have to build data over time. You need to get people involved and you need to look at how things are developing. So like 80% of the children that would be treated in Ireland for cancer are treated on some form of clinical trial. Cleena was on progressively, I think, 4 to 6 clinical trials as she went through. She relapsed and had to look at different things. The importance of clinical trials can't be understated. And in Ireland and with, you know, responsible groups, clinical trials are really, really well regulated. The doctors help us understand why we're signing up to these trials. It's normally to get access to the best available medicine, not the experimental medicine, the best available. And clinical trials have different phases. And it's important to understand when you're signing up to them, how well controlled is this clinical trial? What phase it in? Are they looking at pure safety at the very early, or are they looking on improvement of outcomes at the very late stage clinical trials? And the doctors in Ireland are very good at talking you through them. Like the physicians who treat the children here, they'll explain to parents what's involved. And the one piece of one recommendation I'll give to parents is ask questions. Don't walk out afraid and confused. Take your time, ask your questions about the clinical trials that you may or may not be putting your child on. In particular, work with your physician, the doctors who know your kids best. Work with them to understand whether it's a positive or negative thing. So that's where I think a clinical trial is. And the other thing you touched on, and I think it's something the media do really poorly, is they announce a small, so they'll find a headline from a journal and it'll say, we'll cure cancer in, you know, we have the bullet to cure cancer. And it's like, yeah, but we don't know how long that's going to take and, you know, what types of cancer and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's something that confuses parents. They'll hear like, oh, we've a treatment for your child's cancer, massive breakthrough made. But the reality from going from where Walter sits to where I sit in my day job to making that a medicine that can be taken by the masses to get into your patient is a years long process. It's years long. And the number of people that are number of products that fail, the number of potential medicines that fail between the early research stage and the availability from your pharmacist phase is huge. So I think the media try and sensationalize it. And I think we need as parents to pull ourselves back down and deal with what's in front of us now, what's available now, and how can we look at, you know, what's best for our kids. I think that's an important piece, that perception of the great breakthrough. And then on the other side, you mentioned the horror stories and the difficult stories. And I've seen them with children we went through treatment with. There are things that go wrong, right? Like things go wrong, but you have to weigh in your mind the potential benefit of what you're doing. And no one will ever be in your shoes as a parent to say you had a right or right wrong decision. You have to make the decision that you want to make for the best intents for your child with the information you have at hand. And sometimes that's a lot of information. Sometimes it's a little information. Okay. But, you know, you have to make that decision on the question in front of you, and you do it with the best intent for your kids. So.
How important is it? I imagine high, but you said there to trust the physician, to trust the doctor, to trust the medical team that are there that know your child the most, but to also connect with the parents within, whether it's Childhood Cancer Ireland or parents within the childhood cancer community, to be able to openly talk about where your head is at in these decisions. And to talk to each other around, you know, how you came to a decision or how this weighed upon your shoulders, and to just feel connected to the parents that have walked this path.
I think if you think of it as an everlasting relay race, okay, the only people that have run that relay before you are other parents, right? So staying connected with those ahead of you and those behind you is really, really important. They'll understand, not identical pathways, but they'll understand what you're going through. Through the likes of Childhood Cancer Ireland, a charity I'm so proud to be a part of, because it's parent-focused and patient-focused. It's an organization that grew out of you know, the wards where children are treated. And it grew out of parents wanting to look after other parents and to do the best for children. So that connection is immensely powerful. So I would definitely say to stay connected with those parents that are in your treatment space at the time and the ones ahead and behind. You know, I've been through some really tough times, obviously. And I know other parents have gone through those tough times, and they are some of my best supporters. Actually, it's funny. I was at a festival on the weekend, and I bumped into another couple who went on the treatment journey with us and had the same unfortunate outcome. But it was like meeting old friends, and it was like the most comfortable conversation you can have, because you got to say, you know, there was no explaining. They just knew where you were. So it's incredibly important.
It's like you can fully be yourself with those people, because only they can get it. You don't have to wear your armor. You don't have to show up pretending like I'm strong today. And, you know, you can be in that moment with the people who are so rare in that they also know that feeling. They also know what's happening inside.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But they're a key resource, you know, a key resource. And I think bringing it back to, you know, how we interact with research, one of the things that, you know, the researchers are, and Walter mentioned earlier on, in terms of involving patients, is getting that experience of the patient journey and being able to articulate why what research is doing is important to you and will be important to other parents. And even at the very early aspect, you know, there's the thing called the research question, and Walter's much better positioned to talk about the research question, but using parents and patient advocates to shape that question in the right way is really important. And we're seeing that increasingly, so that someone almost trusts that the question is the right question because it's come shaped and informed by other parents and other patient advocates.
That's actually one of the big things in research. If you ask the right question, that's so important, because in the question you ask is almost already the answer. So asking the right questions is hugely important. And, you know, sometimes we tend to forget about this because we have such wonderful technologies and can do a lot of very cool things in research, but it's still about asking the right questions. And this is, again, yeah, where parents are and patients are extremely wonderful companions, and, you know, sometimes put your head in a very different perspective.
Give me, if you can, an example of that. Like, what do you mean by the right questions?
So, for instance, if you probably ask somebody, do they want better treatment or less side effects? Probably a lot of people would say better treatment, right? Better outcome. I want to survive this. But actually, from patients, you often hear it's more about the quality of life. It's more about, you know, what that life means. And it can be more about reducing side effects rather than just, you know, a cure. So it just puts and that, for instance, as a research question, would completely shift your focus, because it would shifting it from coming up with something what is even more aggressive and therefore better to something what is milder, you know, and where we can keep as much efficacy as possible, but where we focus on reducing the side effects rather than improving the treatment outcomes. So that's just one example. There's many, you know, smaller examples, like in another thing is, you know, we have now this modern technologies like genome sequencing, and there's a lot of anxiety about genome sequencing because, you know, it's personal data and not everybody's comfortable with it. But if you actually, even though people are not comfortable about genome sequencing because they, you know, may be afraid that some information about their family or about any undiscovered diseases gets into the wrong hands. But on the other hand, if you ask them whether they want this, because it will help us to, you know, cure the disease or find better diagnostics, usually it's the answer is yes. And of course, you have to make sure that you have all the safeguards and things. But very often that, you know, what you hear in the headlines is actually not that what patients think, and it's also not that what researchers think. So there's a, you know, long list of these examples, but it's usually actually a lot of small things. You know, it's very rare. It's also not, we are not getting out of bed in the morning and have a great idea. Unfortunately, not. I wish I would have. Ideas come from conversations. You know, conversations like this where you talk to people and all of a sudden it sort of clicks and go, oh, that's it. You know, and many small clicks then often shape a big idea. But these many small clicks may not happen in your head only. It happens around the table. And this is why it's important to work as teams and have all these different views.
Do you think the clinical side of research was too clinical for too long? And actually missing the humans.
Oh, we were all sitting in ivory towers. I mean, research, when I started doing research, there was no this discussion about patients. You know, we did this in an ivory tower. And it was nice in this ivory tower, very cozy. But it's not the real world. And I think we fortunately have discovered this. And I mean, this is completely changed. This has changed in research. This has changed in clinical medicine, fortunately. But still some leftovers of the ivory tower. And for instance, this sensationalism is actually a little bit like one of these leftovers, you know, where I say, oh, we have the cure. It's unfortunately, medicine is complicated. Humans are complicated. You know, the even breakthroughs usually only help a limited number of people. Like we had the immunotherapies, you know, they were hailed as the big breakthrough. And they work. They do work, but they don't work for everybody. You know, so breakthrough is all relative. And the sensationalism is actually making our life a lot more difficult because, you know, it's sometimes the headlines look like, well, we've cured everything. And so if we fail, we just fail because we are not intelligent enough or are not trying hard enough. So I think we have to be realistic. And in terms of putting this again back into perspective.
Is it hard for you, given what you do, what you just said there, like, I'm not intelligent enough or I'm not trying hard enough, as a researcher whose pursuit is to change the lives of many? How hard is it for you that sometimes days pass and you're like, we didn't crack it today, or we didn't, what you're looking for didn't happen? Do you beat yourself up sometimes thinking like, I'm not trying hard enough, or I need to do more tomorrow? How do you set safe boundaries for you and your brain?
That's actually a very good question, because I've seen a lot of people went into research and actually couldn't cope with the expectations on themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to, it's proceeding very slowly. You have to do also your due diligence. And even if you're a good idea in the breakthrough, you have to test it. And you have to make sure that it's really a breakthrough. You have to make sure that this is safe. You have to make sure that, you know, this actually can be used. You know, and doing all this takes a long time and can be very hard. And a lot of people, a lot of researchers just keep questioning themselves, was this really good enough? Is this really? So it can be a little bit of a frustrating life. But again, this is why it's important to do this as a team, you know, because you also need support as a researcher. In, you know, you need, and as I said earlier, like meeting with patients, you know, that sort of gives you the stamina that you can go through these phases where, you know, scratch your head and say, God, I can't crack this. You know, it keeps you going.
It's a really interesting insight, Walter. That's really interesting. You know, because in my day job, where we have to get medicine to patients, that's our job. We have to manufacture, we have to commercialize product to get to patients. When there's a success in getting a product to a patient, especially a new product, you know, I make a point to tell in my teams that somewhere on that product that got to that patient is your fingerprint. No one else will see it, but you'll know that your fingerprint is on that. And if you think all the way back to where we started talking about samples and DNA signatures and what parents have to sign up to, that's what inspires me as well, is that like cleanest fingerprint will carry through all of those layers, years of research. And then when some patient gets some vial or some syringe or some tablet, one of the thousands and thousands of fingerprints on that will be the child's, it'll be the parent advocate, it'll be the researcher, it'll be the guys who got it to manufacture, it'll be the doctor who gave it to them. There's thousands of fingerprints on that. And I think that's a way of reassuring people when they get into that idea of, am I working hard enough? Did I make enough, a big enough difference? Just think that somewhere your fingerprint's going to be on that, right? It won't be the only one, but it will be there.
It's actually a very nice analogy. Mm. And very true.
Yeah.
What an amazing thing to be part of. And what an amazing thing to put your fingerprint on. With, I think some things are contagious. Okay. Some things negative are contagious, but some things positive are contagious. And I think being able to collect and being able to join forces and have that synergy of so many people that are just on the same mission, actually working together, is contagious.
Yeah.
And it can only lead to momentum. And momentum can only lead to small breakthroughs, Walter. I won't sensationalize, but small breakthroughs. But anything, any progress is progress. And how brilliant that this group was formed. They came together. They stay together. That, Walter, you're leading this together. That is truly magnificent work.
Yeah, it's magnificent teamwork. The emphasis here is really on the team, because, you know, bringing all these smart people together to, you know, solve some really fundamental questions. I think that's actually very rewarding, you know, to work with these people every day.
Many of these conversations on these podcasts have been about what has happened in the past. Stories of where people started and the journey that they've gone on, the lessons they might have learned along the way, and sometimes some of the insights and feelings they want to express to those that are still on the journey or at the beginning. This episode is very much looking to the future and what people have learned either in ivory towers or through loss can do together to somehow change the future landscape, to change what's going to happen next. And that is truly inspiring, incredibly motivating. And I say this, like, I'm privileged to have been let into the worlds of the guests that I have on this podcast, each and every one. But this is special because this is about the future. I cry in everyone, so don't. I think it's impossible not to, but this is about the future. And that is special. That is really special. Thank you for the work that you do and for sharing this work with us on the podcast, and of course Alan, for all of the work that you do at Childhood Cancer Ireland anyway. But I hope that anybody listening takes real courage and real reassurance, actually, that there are people all putting their fingerprints to what is to come, and they are truly not alone. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Gold Ribbon Conversation. There are more Gold Ribbon stories written by those fighting childhood cancer on our website, childhoodcancer.ie, and you'll find a link in our show notes. If you can, we would love you to share this podcast across social media using hashtag Gold Ribbon Conversations, as it can help more families to discover this show. This podcast was produced by The Brand Story for Childhood Cancer Ireland, hosted by Sinead O'Moore, and sound production by Alan Breslin.